If you would like to call in for any comment on the item that we have before us tonight, please call at 805-321-6639. So our item He's got a green light.
Yeah. All right, well, this is what you would expect after not having a meeting for 3 years.
Yes.
If the podium mic is working, maybe you want to just move to that. If they think it's going to take them a few minutes, I guess. That one works.
This one looks like it
works. That one wasn't working either, but this one is working. So, do you have that muted over there?
These are just always on, aren't they? Yeah, there's no way to turn them on.
Your mics are working?
This isn't working. Mine isn't working.
Okay. You push the button?
Yeah.
The public mic there on top of the stand, what about that guy? Nah. Please continue.
All right, you can hear me even better now.
Oh, a little bit. You increased your volume.
All right, so as I was saying, did see at the workshop a few weeks ago, and so Genevieve with MIG is here again tonight. The presentation's a little bit more condensed, a little bit less background, but she will review those salient points for the commission as well as the public. So one final thing, you do have some correspondence you received, two items from the public that are in front of you. So with that, I will turn it over to Genevieve.
Thank you, and I think it's not okay. Good evening, Chair and members of the Commission, and thanks for having me tonight to talk about the Development Code. It's an exciting project that we are nearing culmination, as Bruce mentioned. So I'll just give tonight a really brief project recap of where we came from and how we got to today, and go over the draft Development Code update changes that are proposed. We have most of them, as Bruce mentioned, these are all surrounding the topic of housing and furthering housing in the community. And there's a few other kind of fix-it list kind of things that staff has bugged staff, and we were able to make those modifications as well. There's also some amendments to the general plan land use element that we'll go through tonight. So back to the purpose, as Bruce mentioned, this is coming out of not only the City Council's housing and homelessness goals and the strategic plan, but also the housing element implementation. This really is the direct result of those goals, policies, and programs that are in the housing element. The city was able to secure grants to further this project along, SB2, REAP, and LEAP grants. And as we were doing the update, more housing laws were updated, and so we're able to fold those in as well, even if they weren't mentioned in the housing element. And then those other minor amendments and cleanup items are also included. So we began the process about a year ago now. We talked to a variety of stakeholders, architects, developers in the community to talk about what works and what doesn't within the existing code and what can we really do to further those goals along. We met with the commission and council back in the fall to talk about some of those big key kind of policy issues that we wanted to get your direction on early on. We had those two workshops in September, October, and reaffirmed some of that direction with council in November. We were quiet for a little bit here for a while we went to work on making those actual changes, and we came back last month with that workshop to go over what those changes are. So now we're here tonight with some minor modifications to those, just a few things. And just to note as well, this was a project under CEQA, so a negative declaration was prepared. No comments were received on that document. So since that April workshop, we did make a few kind of cleanup items as we went through the document. So there were, at that workshop, we heard from you and the council to affirm the draft as it stood and that staff should proceed with these public hearings. Some of those refinements we looked at were mostly cleanup, typo, kind of clarity of order kind of changes. We made a few changes in Chapter 3. These are the development standards chapter with regard to landscape coverage and how that is defined in Chapter 4. We made a few more changes to make sure that we had parallel structure with regard to the different types of objective design standards to make it easier to implement. And staff also looked at updating the subdivision ordinance, that's Chapter 8, to really modernize it. It hadn't been touched in a really long time, so that brought it up to modern standards, clarified review authorities with a nice table to really make that more user-friendly as well. Chapter 9 to that same end as well. More definitions so that both staff, the public, and decision makers can have confidence in the decisions that you're making with really clear definitions. So on the development code update, the first topic we'd like to talk about are some changes to land uses and some site planning changes. So again, most of these changes are in line with those housing goals. So paralleling some of the same structure and terminology that we're using throughout the code for multi-unit attached, multi-unit detached, single-unit dwellings, those are now showing up in your land use table as permitted uses. And also a change to senior housing to allow that as a permitted use and not with a use permit. This is in the residential zones. In commercial zones, additional changes were made to use permits to allow communal housing. This is a new evolving type of housing that is also an old type of housing, sometimes formerly referred to as boarding houses, but some kind of newer ideas about communal housing and the popularity of this type of housing are also coming up. So this is added to the CBO district to be allowed with a use permit. Low barrier navigation centers. This is a type of emergency shelter that has low barrier to entry. So you can bring your spouse or your pet to get into this to the shelter. And this, by state law, is required to be allowed by right in any commercial zone that allows residential, commercial or industrial zone that allows residential. So those are reflected in the code as well. We also, in order to streamline housing development, removed the use permit requirement for any multifamily or multi-unit attached dwellings, senior housing, and in response to a policy in the housing element, also for daycare centers. Industrial zones were also updated to allow some new uses. Currently, the CIC zone allows work-live units. We also updated it to allow mixed-use projects within the CIC zone, as well as lodging with a use permit. Low-barrier navigation centers, similar to the commercial zones, would also be allowed, and also allowing a commercial recreation facility indoor in all of the different zones with a use permit. With regard to some site planning changes, currently the five-story height limit is allowed in some specific locations along Grand Avenue. Through our discussions in the fall with you and the council, it was determined to apply it to the area highlighted on the map here, and to look at allowing or encouraging more height in the ground floor to have a really effective commercial ground floor space of a 15-foot height for that ground floor active space. We also looked at reduced setbacks in the residential zones. So because we're looking at encouraging more of that missing middle, affordable by design type housing in the residential zones, in order to facilitate that development, the front setbacks were reduced by 5 feet to facilitate that type of development. Fractional density, this is also key to encouraging that affordability by design and really encouraging more smaller units that can be affordable by virtue of just the fact that they are smaller. So this fractional density will play out so that if a unit is smaller than 600 square feet, it's counted as half a unit. If it's between 6 and 1,000 square feet, it's a two-thirds of a unit, and any over 1,000 square feet are considered a unit. And when we were looking at these in particular, we were thinking about how the existing planned unit developments are developed and how this missing middle design could fit into that scene. So on the left is the existing planned unit developments that have been developed in town, and on the right are some of the other designs that could effectively be allowed by the new regulations. So effectively maybe 3 2,000 square foot homes, and now we could allow 6 1,000 square foot homes through the new regulations. To facilitate that as well, the key driver of site planning is often parking. And so looking at the parking reductions and where those would be most beneficial, multi-unit residential and mixed-use projects that activate that fractional density for at least half of the project do have a different parking requirement to make that site planning work. The guest parking requirement is waived, and the minimum parking requirement is reduced down to one space per unit, regardless of how many bedrooms it has. For PUDs, for the planned unit developments, or that multi-unit detached cluster type development, the requirement for a garage is removed, and this is parallel to the single-family requirements in town. To also facilitate that development on Grand Avenue, the commercial requirement for mixed-use projects was also modified. When we looked at site planning with the fractional densities, a minor reduction to the parking for the commercial component actually went a long way to making those projects site plan out. Open space standards are another key critical component in site planning, and we wanted to provide more flexibility for developers and architects as they looked at open space. So rather than requiring open space for multi-unit developments to be in the form of a balcony or private open space or in the form of common open space, we're providing flexibility so that the open space could be provided as private or common or a combination of those two. So you could have a great rooftop open garden, but we wouldn't necessarily require there to be balconies in each location. So that's just to provide more flexibility in site design. And in the commercial and industrial zones, it was the requirements were slightly lowered to remove the requirement for ground floor open space and to reduce the upper floor units to 60 square feet per unit. Landscaping requirements and standards were also clarified and reduced. And a lot of this also was in the language of how the city looks at what hardscape is and what softscape is and what that landscaping actually means, so that we're effectively getting the landscaping that you want closer to the front where you can see it, closer to the front setback, and where you want it to buffer commercial from residential uses. So we were strategic in, while slightly reducing it, strategic in where that landscaping is focused to really provide the most benefit to the public realm. And then for the objective design standards. So this was a large portion of the work that was done, and this is in response to the state's Housing Accountability Act, which states that cities cannot deny or reduce the density of projects that are residential or mixed use, if they're two-thirds residential, if they comply with objective standards. So this is in direct response to that law and to try and create a structure and a process whereby housing projects have certainty but are meeting clear standards that the city has put forth for high-quality design. So this all now lives in Chapter 4 of the Development Code, and it's broken down into five sections when we have also some SB9 parts, but it's really broken down into these main parts, the single-unit developments, multi-unit detached or cluster developments, the former PUD, multi-unit attached smaller, so these are between 2 and 9 units, and multi-unit attached and mixed-use larger, and that's more than 10 units. And the intent is really to have, again, those very clear standards with kind of more focus on higher design quality as the project increases in size. The objective design standards cover quite a bit of things, looking at site planning and where buildings are required to be, primary entrances, where parking is located, to think about really how to make, especially along West Grand Avenue, that pedestrian orientation and access to the public realm really welcoming. We look at massing as well as circulation, both pedestrian and vehicular. How do you design parking? What are the building amenities on site? And then, importantly, what is the articulation and the materials? How is there variation in the building to make sure that it is not a blank box? Thinking through that as well with building transparency in the windows, and then some of those ugly things that are hard to hide, some of the utilities and service areas. One of the key considerations, of course, is adjacencies and how a project reacts to its neighbors. So we have privacy considerations with the location of windows not being directly across from each other, but offsetting, so they're not looking into neighbors' windows. And also considering when a project in the mixed use zone or in the commercial zones is adjacent to the residential zone, considering that adjacency to require a step back at upper stories, and that follows along a 40-degree setback plane line. There are also massing considerations. So in the single unit and the multi-unit detached, the requirement for an 80% reduction in massing on the second story. And this parallels what's already in the code for the planned unit developments, and this is now carried forward for all single-unit and multi-unit detached developments. With regard to the multi-unit attached, for anything that would go over 3 stories would be required to address massing through one of these kind of menu of options. So in the code, we tried to provide options so that we don't have cookie cutter or any kind of consistency, but options for an architect to choose to provide that articulation while addressing some of the key concerns. One of the other key points is where entrances are. This focal point of an entryway can really change a building, especially a smaller single unit or multi-unit detached. So we have requirements for an entryway that has some kind of focal point that draws your eye and creates depth and perception in the facade. So entryways are required, but those are allowed to be encroached into the setback areas. With multi-unit attached, also we looked at what are the required entryways for both the residential component as well as the commercial component. We're providing lots of examples so that we can point to those to show developers what those kind of key items mean and can provide guidance and ideas for those entrances. Facade articulation is also required for the single unit and multi-unit detached so that we don't have just a flat facade. So anytime you have more than 25 feet, you are required to vary that in some way. That can be the garage setback and the porch, and you could achieve it with that, or provide some kind of variation in that plane so that it's not one big flat facade. And also looking at building materials, multiple building materials can really add to that depth perception and interest that the facade has. With this, the same for multi-unit attached, this also has a variety of options to choose from to achieve that articulation and outlines what those particular things are that you can choose from to achieve that depth and interest and intrigue. One of the other key components is how these projects are processed. So there is some additions to the review authority table. This all lives in Chapter 6 of the code. And there's a couple of new permit processes that are proposed here. So currently, right now, most of the housing will require a development permit and goes before the Planning Commission. So to follow in line with the Housing Accountability Act and to really accelerate the housing production, for smaller projects, there are some different processes that are proposed. So the first is this zoning clearance, which is a new permit process. And this is used to verify compliance with standards against the objective design standards and all standards within the city, as well as to allow a use that is allowed by right. They would go through this zoning clearance process. And so this is projects, residential projects that are 4 or fewer, mixed-use projects that are 9 or fewer, and this would be approved at the staff level. There is also an administrative development permit. This also is used to verify standards and compliance with those standards, but it does have findings associated with it as well. This will be used for small non-residential additions. So now every larger project would come before the Planning Commission. Every residential project with 5 or more units would come through the Planning Commission through the development permit, or mixed use with 10 or more. And any subdivision, regardless of the size, also requires a public hearing with the Planning Commission. So that is a modification, but it kind of streamlines those smaller projects that can comply with the objective design standards through this streamlined pathway and provides an opportunity for the Planning Commission to weigh in on some of the larger projects. There is also a new process proposed called the modifications to standards process. And this allows for minor deviations from standards or an alternative pathway if a project doesn't want to comply with the objective design standards. So some of the minor ones are, you know, a minor deviation from the required landscaping requirement or the amount of paving or maybe a 10% deviation from a list of things that are included. And those minor ones can be done at the staff level. However, the major modifications to standards would come before the Planning Commission, and that is that pathway for developers who would like to not use those objective design standards, but would like a different pathway to approval, and that goes through that discretionary process with you. And that would be any deviation for a new project, a new development project that deviates from objective design standards, or that chooses to do two of those minor exceptions. That takes it out of staff level review and kicks it up to the Planning Commission level. The administrative use permit was removed from the code, and those uses, there were only a few uses that used that process. They were either adjusted to be permitted by right or as a use permit. If they were permitted by right, we added additional standards, performance standards, to address those. SB9, you might have heard of, is a new law. So there's still a lot of conjecture about how it will be implemented, what the results will be. And every city in the state is kind of in the same situation of learning as we go. But this law allows duplexes and lot splits on those traditionally single-family properties, resulting in up to 4 units per parcel. So if a lot split occurs, it could be up to 4 units. Otherwise, it would be 2 units with the duplex, with some variations if there's also an allowed ADU. ADUs are not allowed if there is a lot split. So projects under SB 9 similarly can only be held to those objective design standards, which unequivocally must allow those 2 units or 4 units with a lot split of at least 800 square feet per. So the units cannot be short-term rented if they are processed through SB 9. They generally don't have to be owner-occupied unless they are on a lot split, in which case the applicant is required to sign an affidavit that they will be living there for 3 years. So it's still very new, and I think we'll learn a lot over the next year or two in Grover Beach. The law was written to mirror state law and implement state law and be consistent with state law. Approval of through this process will also be through a zone clearance and allows for ministerial lot splits as well, consistent with the law. Other minor modifications: office professional was removed from the zoning map and the code. There were only these 2 tiny areas that were zoned that OP, and those are rezoned as CBO for consistency. There were a few other minor changes, all either to comply with state law or directly as a result of what the housing element said to do. There were also a few revisions to the industrial zones, including allowing those uses that we mentioned, and a minor increase in height to allow some of those uses to occur, and lot coverage and FAR to facilitate that type of development. Throughout the code, there were some other minor modifications, typos corrected, some other ways that things are calculated, like lot coverage. Again, thinking about making it very clear how things are calculated to make those objective standards as objective as possible, so there's less need for interpretation. The same with encroachments into setbacks and heights, making it very clear what belongs within the height and setback envelopes. Garage sale regulations were previously accidentally deleted. Those are added back in as they were. And street improvement and utility undergrounding thresholds were also updated. The land use element in parallel was also moderately updated to align more with objective design standards. Some kind of subjective standards do remain, because as those discretionary projects do come to the Planning Commission, it's helpful to have some of those policies there for the Commission to rely on in making decisions, and also to point to what the true intent and guidance that the city has for developers. Industrial design policies were also updated to reference existing industrial design guidelines. And that concludes the presentation. Happy to answer any questions you might have. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much for the presentation. It is remarkably like the one we heard at the joint meeting with City Council. So yeah, it's good to see these. There's a lot of stuff there, so it's good to see it more than one time. Do the commissioners have any questions, comments? Yes, sir.
I'm just going to conclude by making clear tonight that staff is recommending that the Planning Commission recommend to the City Council that you adopt this ordinance update. So that's the action before you tonight.
Right. We're not approving it. You're
correct.
Okay. And if I may, I forgot one other thing. There was a communication that staff had with the Coastal Commission who recommended that we do add a couple of references to the fact that the local coastal plant program will apply and potentially supersede some of the objective design standards. So they want an additional caveat added to probably 2 sections to say that.
All right.
Yeah, once the commission has deliberated tonight and you're going to make your motion, we'll give you some language that you include in your motion.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Commissioner Rodman, you have questions?
You're going to, as before, you're going to stay with us through our discussion in case we have questions later.
Absolutely.
Good. And I just want to comment that this is at least the 3rd presentation that that I've heard from you, and even though, you know, the presentations are similar, I have always learned more and more every time you have presented them. So I just want to thank you for your presentations and how concise and understanding there are from my maybe my lack of experience in the field. It's still understandable. So thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Anyone else? Questions? Comments? Okay. I think you're done for the moment then. I'll open it up to a public hearing, and I have one speaker slip from Rachel Mann.
Thank you. I believe this did make it into the correspondence you received. Thank you, Chair, Commissioners, City Staff. My name is Rachel Mann. I'm a homeowner in the Ocean Oaks Plan Development at Ramona and North 16th Avenues in Grover Beach. I do serve on the HOA board, but these comments are my own. I first want to applaud our city staff and the consultants for their work on this draft land use element. There are many changes to commend that I believe will lead to more abundant energy and water efficient homes. I'm proud we are leading the region on this. There are two sections that impact me a little more directly, and since I haven't read this through to see if it's 3 minutes, they are, I'd like to understand if my home will be legal to rebuild should it get, you know, fire or some other thing, because as I read, it appears that it's still not within the, it's not complying with what we've got here. And the other is that there are some parcels across the street from me that are zoned RC, which is more commercial and allows auto-centric uses. Those parcels right now have people living on them in residences, and I'm concerned that there would no longer be residential there. So regarding section 2.20.020, which is the F high density residential zone, R3, Ocean Oaks is 34 attached row homes contained in 5 buildings. We're on 1.25 acres, as I was able to measure it, which is 27.2 dwelling units per acre. We are zoned R3. And each unit is at least a little over 1,000 square feet, so we would count as one unit, even under the new fractional density. We were built in 1981, and by the text included in the document, we're considered small lot attached single family or multi-unit, but I own the ground underneath it. Even with the proposed changes, it appears we're still over the 20 dwelling unit acre limit, which is listed for R3. So I'd like some confidence that should the building burn down, we can rebuild with the same number of units, and with hopefully as little red tape as necessary. The other concern I have, and this is just because I don't know how height gets counted. I don't know how tall we are, but we are 3 stories tall, and the height limit for R3 is 32 feet. So we may exceed that at this point, too. I'm looking for the time to see where I'm at.
Go ahead.
Okay. the other item is regarding the retail commercial zones, which is 2.30.020, which does preference more auto-centric uses. But the parcels across the street from me, which are on the south side of Ramona Avenue between Oak Park and North 14th Street, are zoned RC. Most of these parcels currently have residences, including a mobile home park. The preference of auto-centric uses for the RC zone, like drive-through, vehicle rentals, repair, sales, over the more pedestrian-friendly uses of CBO for these residential parcels, I think is counterproductive to our city's other goals of being more pedestrian-friendly. So if we're going to zone such that these single-story homes get redeveloped, I'd much prefer more neighbors to more cars, even if the homes are tall and block my view. So, but maybe that's better addressed not through this land use element, but another zoning review. So thank you for your time and attention to these concerns.
All right, very good. Thank you. So as Director Buckingham mentioned earlier, we did have a couple of correspondences, which I'd like to acknowledge receipt of, one from Jimmy Summer and one from Christina Jeffries. So those are entered into the record as well. Seeing no one else in the audience, do we have anyone calling in that would be interested in speaking?
We do not.
We do not. Okay, then I will close the public comment portion of this item, and I guess I would like to revert to staff to answer some of Rachel's questions.
Sure. So the simple answer to Ms. Matt's question is that while I don't know, because we didn't calculate it, if the density or building height or something is non-conforming, meaning that when it was constructed in circa 1980, it did meet the standards at that time. If and fire is the most common or occurrence, if something were to happen that were to destroy the building, it could be rebuilt to its existing parameters, if you will, density, mm-hmm. height, and so forth. So that's a typical non-conforming clause because from an insurance standpoint, you want to insure and be able to rebuild what you have on the site. So that's and quite frankly, that's one of the few parts of the code we aren't updating as part of this comprehensive update. And the other, she talks about the retail commercial, the RC zone. And again, that was one zone that we didn't focus on because it does have some housing potential and redevelopment, and actually she raises a good point, along Ramona between 16th and Oak Park. There probably are some opportunities for redevelopment there. But again, we didn't really focus on the RC zone because most of it is built out with our commercial centers like Vaughn's and the McDonald's, Wells Fargo, and so forth. So it just wasn't a focus of this because that wasn't the greatest new housing opportunity. But I think there are issues raised that could be discussed as part of a future update.
Okay. The other point I think she was making is that if we change the code and not allow things that we allowed in the past, there's no requirement for people to go back and modify their structures to meet the new code. If suddenly we reduce the height limit, they don't have to chop off the top of their buildings. Those things just exist. They're considered non-conforming, but there's no legal requirement for them to change them to adapt to new code requirements. Correct?
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
Well, I just have... I'm not familiar with Ocean Oaks. It's on Ramona and 14th?
Northeast corner of 16th and Ramona.
Sort of
so kind of behind the skate park, or across street from the skate park, and what else is there? The mobile home park.
There's a duplex and a small single-family home on the south side of Ramona there, and then our complex. There's 34 units and a pool and a parking lot and a little...
I think I know. Recognize it now, and that's an HOA, right?
It has an HOA.
So the audience part of it is concluded. So sorry, that's okay. It was kind of like you were asked, so
right.
I won't hold it against you.
Okay, that's all.
That's all. Okay, very good. So public comments completed. Is there any discussion among the commissioners regarding this item?
No.
Okay, well, that was relatively easy. Do I have an assistance from staff for a motion?
Yes, so there were two things Genevieve alluded to. Section, the objective design standard, section 4.25.010, we will add some clarifying language that any project needs to also be consistent with a local coastal program. And then in section 8.20.060, there's a nice new review authority table on subdivisions, and it should have a footnote, again, indicating that those projects, if in the coastal zone, would require a coastal development permit. This is our coastal staff that we interact with, just making sure that there's always consistency with the Coastal Act. And then lastly, my mistake, you need to adopt with your motion a local coastal program amendment resolution, and it's, I think Rafael's going to show it to you, but it's, you've seen this before, it's a one-page resolution that basically the council will approve that authorizes me to submit the application to the Coastal Commission, because the Coastal Commission does review the development code changes for the areas that are within the coastal zone, and so... that part becomes effective once they review that, which will follow the council's approval. So if you can add those three changes to your...
Is someone brave enough to make a motion?
You can say,
can I go back?
As mentioned,
I'm sorry.
I'd make the motion, but will you read it?
you can say as with amendments as noted by staff.
Could I? I'm sorry.
Sure, go ahead.
I misunderstood your question. I thought we were still talking about the public comment.
Oh, no, we closed that portion.
And so I do have some concerns I'd like to go back and discuss with the and get your input on.
Okay, sure.
And the commission. Input.
Go right ahead.
If I may.
Please.
Okay. Thank you. I'm sorry for
the
confusion on my part. I think it's section 3-1 that mentions that mechanical equipment, elevators can extend, and these concern residential units mostly, that mechanical equipment, I guess that's like air conditioners, and elevators can extend beyond the 25-foot limit in a residential R1 house. I disagree. I think that if 25 is the limit, then 25 should be without an exception. What does the commission feel?
Yeah, I think this was discussed at our joint meeting. It
right.
came up because the consultant brought that up as a very specific change that was
right.
going to be allowed. And there are requirements to screen those things as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
The council seemed to think that was all right, and I didn't see any objection to it either. I think part of the reasoning was that, especially for the elevator shafts, the population is aging. Elevators are becoming more of a requirement with our population. And there was no wish to restrict the usable space in the building just to keep the smaller space of the elevator shaft below the height limit. And the other thing I think was that in addition to screening, normally those elevator equipment rooms are set back into the building, and so they're less visible from the street. Does staff any comment beyond that?
You know, I would just add that under a mechanical equipment, I can't think of any instances on residential projects. I mean, maybe you have a large apartment project or something, you'd have mechanical equipment on a roof, and again, the point here is really to ensure that it's screened as well. So those screens would need to be architecturally integrated. And I can just tell you from personal experience in a larger building like that that's going to have roof mount equipment, your AC condensers or something like that, the typical method is you would, A, want those to be pulled back from the edges so they're not on the edge of the building, clustered more towards the center of the building, screen just high enough, you know, the screen only needs to be as high as the equipment, and that in and of itself creates more of a visual buffer because, again, you're pulling that back. I don't think the intention of this is not to plop some things on your roof and then build a whole other wall atop the perimeter to make it look like it's a larger building. This is
right.
Really,
you're getting at my concern. My concern is this, even not necessarily the mechanical, but whatever architectural design is put on the roof, you know, how high is that? We don't have a limit on that. It just extends into the 25-foot. And, of course, I'm sure the commission's aware that I'm very much in favor of protecting view sheds. And the more you put on a 25-foot roof, the more you're going to cut down on somebody's view. Anything else?
I just had a question. Are elevator shafts allowed to go above the 25 feet in single-family homes?
This provision would allow it, up to 8 feet.
8 feet.
Quite frankly, I'm not so sure you really get to 8 feet. If you want to follow me for a moment, Cody can understand this. If you have a rooftop deck in this city, you have to have a 42-inch railing by code.
So that means your building height is only 21 and a half feet because you have to have that 3.5 feet for the railing.
Oh.
So if you consider the top of a roof at 21 and a half and you add, I can't tell you the exact height of a elevator shaft, but let's say it's 8.5 feet.
It's probably at least 8.
So 21 and a half, and we'll call it 8.5, gets you to 30. Well, the height limit's 25 feet. You're probably typically only talking about 5 feet. We went with 8 feet because in a commercial application, we wanted to make sure that there would be potential for a larger elevator that might have a larger height. So
yeah, sometimes there's equipment on top of the elevator.
Correct.
That adds height.
Correct.
Yeah.
And to Commissioner Robin, I would just add, too, that in my example of roof-mounted equipment at an apartment project, of course, that wouldn't be applicable to an R1.
No,
what do we
no.
see in R1 zones?
Right.
We have sloped roofs.
Right.
I don't think there's a piece of the mechanical equipment on a roof anywhere. And if there was, it would never, there would be no reason for our to exceed
right.
25.
Well, I wouldn't want to, I'm very much in favor of solar cells on roofs, so I wouldn't want to limit that. But Cody, could you give me an idea of, so 25 feet is the limit.
Mm-hmm.
If you had 8 feet elevator
mm-hmm.
requirement or ladder requirement in R1, mm-hmm. then that would mean the living space inside would be 18, 17 feet. Could you build a 17-foot, two-story building and have living space inside on both floors, or would they have to be short people?
You can typically do 2 9-foot plates, and then you have the floor thickness of the second floor and the roof.
Right.
So and with your roof deck railing,
yeah.
you're right there at the 25 feet.
Okay. And we don't have anybody, people that are 9 feet tall. Right? So that would allow, it wouldn't cut down on the living space, it would cut down on blocking somebody's view. If you were to
you
lower the building in order to make an elevator or a ladder, which would be the applicant's choice to do.
So you're saying maybe if you're going to do an elevator, you may have to adjust your plate heights a little lower.
Right.
That's a thought.
Okay.
Makes it a little more complicated, but.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I don't know the mathematics involved, mm-hmm. but you probably do.
I'm electrical, I don't
know. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, there could be some like condition to recess the elevator in away from the outside walls to hide it a little more.
Right.
A little better.
So, okay.
Yeah.
So, given that, is there, before I go on with my other concerns, is there any support for including, making the 25-foot limit the actual, including mechanical?
No, so not granting an exception for
right, not granting.
Elevator.
That would be to say it. Thank you, Chairman.
Sure. Yeah, no problem. I would prefer to keep it the way it is because I think the building heights, the max limit is based on a well-designed building with or without an elevator. And so now if you're going to compress the building because you're going to penalize them for having an elevator shaft for to accommodate disabilities or whatever, I don't think that is a good change
okay.
myself.
All right. Any comments from the other commissioner?
Yeah, I think you just have to really do something decoratively or design that elevator shaft or screen it somehow to blend in with the existing architecture.
Okay.
Yeah, I would agree. What's your next item?
Okay. Parking. 3.5, it reduced parking. Some other sections reduced parking, which means, and I already see a problem of too many cars in a residential area parked on the street. And if we continue to reduce parking on residential as well as commercial houses, we're only going to increase the number of cars that are parking on the street.
Yeah, and this is a concern that both of us share. However, right. the state is stepping in and requiring us to do this, and we do have a housing shortage. And the trade-off, I mean the trade-offs we're making here in this change are making a lot of, more sense to me, especially the ones where we're talking about giving credit for partial occupancy. So. If it's only one unit and it's relatively small, maybe one car does make sense. One space on site makes sense. But I do share your concern. I share your concern about a lot of the things that the state has right. imposed on us. But we right. still have to live under those constraints and make it work.
Yeah, and we have a good public transportation system, so I'm hoping it would encourage a little bit more of that.
I would hope so.
Yeah.
I agree with that hope. I haven't seen it, mm-hmm. but yes, I would agree.
Yeah, it's a societal change, really. I mean, we're dependent on our cars, all of us.
Mm-hmm. And, right.
And we have to be weaned away from them, slowly but painfully.
Mm-hmm. And then Section 4.1, I think it is, ADUs, second floors, and residential units, 80% to me, 80% of the second story. Well, it's 80% less of the second story. Is that
of the first floor?
Of the first floor. So the second floor is smaller.
So the second story is 80% less of the first floor.
80.
So, am I saying it backwards?
Yeah.
Okay.
So if you got 100% on the first floor, it can only be 80% of that on the second floor.
So that. It's not a setback, but
it can be.
But I agree that limits the massing somewhat. You don't have a straight wall on all four walls, mm-hmm. and it does allow a little more view shed from adjacent buildings. But I'm not. I don't think 80% is enough.
Okay.
75% even. 80% is. Just a little bit, and
yeah. So,
and I'm giving up that. Yes, your second story. We are allowing 25-foot structures. They're going to block a view. And when somebody buys a house that has an empty lot in front of it on a hillside, they have to expect that their view is going to be obstructed somewhat. But I'm just trying to limit the amount of that obstruction. And cutting it down to 75% seems one way, or 70% seems one way to allow for more views.
Yeah, so the whole idea of that reduction in the second floor is not for view shed, obviously. It's to get rid of that massing issue.
Yes,
it's
I agree.
It's the appearance.
We'll do that.
And,
yeah.
and another way, it also is you mentioned setback. It's a setback. For the second floor to give maybe a little more privacy to adjacent properties.
Right.
So changing it to 75 or 70, again, restricts the architect's ability to design that second floor. And it really isn't going to make much of a difference for view shed. That's not really the point of the whole thing. I mean, you might as well say no second stories. How far do you go? Again, I would...
And the applicant has... the flexibility to move that left or right, center it,
sure,
or divide it amongst all four sides, or
of
whatever.
Of course, and so his.
So he has that flexibility. So 75%, if he moved it all to one side, would get quite a bit more.
He has the flexibility to make it 20% if he wants. It's what the city is requiring him to do,
right?
And so he can do it any way he wants to, as long as it's 80% or less.
Okay.
I was going to add, is our exterior stairs to the roof deck included in that 80% or no?
They are included.
So it does count as part of the 80%?
Correct.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, we see a lot of roof deck. That is part of the mass of the building, mm-hmm. but one could argue, again, these things do erode at that.
Right. So if they have a spiral staircase, that has to be within... The 80%.
Yes.
Well, that helps. Sure.
Yeah. A little open spiral staircase.
Yeah. Well, and you can see through to that top deck either inside or out.
Yep.
Correct. Right.
Okay. Anything else?
Yeah. Can I go on?
Please.
Garage sales. Section 4, garage sales. They're suggesting 4 garage sales a year from one resident. And I think that's twice too many. I think 4, and because also it's not really, the way I understand it, it's not enforced until somebody complains. So if people knew, were to complain at 3, maybe they add 4. But if we give them a threshold of 4, they could have had 5 and nobody complained. And so they had 5, 6, or 7 a year, and that's way too many for a resident. So they, you know, a resident is going to keep track of how many garage sales they've had. But if you cut it to 2, I think you need to get, and a resident decides to have more than 2, then I think that's going to start to alert neighbors. Where 4, I don't think is going to alert them as much. And then, and these are all, each garage sale is permitted or no?
There is no permit.
There is no permit at all?
No.
Okay.
So I think, you know, at the last joint meeting, in fact, I think you may have brought this up at the last joint meeting,
right.
Staff explained that this was something just to keep people from abusing the right to have a garage sale. And,
right.
And that there, in the past, there have been very few abusers of garage sales. But it happens.
That's opinion.
And
from my point of view.
And this was left out of the last revisions of the
right.
codes inadvertently. So now that it's back in again, we can start enforcing it again. If there are any abusers out there, and I don't know, I think city staff at the last meeting kind of said that there wasn't any that were known at this point. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, if it's truly a garage sale and you're selling your own household items. If you're having 4 a year, you've got a lot of stuff you're selling.
Sure.
What this is also candidly trying to prevent are we've had people who bring in goods
right.
from offsite.
Exactly.
And quite frankly, the I think the neighbors are tolerant of garage sales, but they're not tolerant when someone keeps on bringing in the same kind of stuff. So
exactly.
Again, the purpose of this and is to prevent that. And we've had a few neighborhood situations where the neighbors have been very vigilant, and we can easily document. And once they get to their 4 in their calendar year, they get a $100 citation if they have a 5th one. So,
right. I appreciate it. I remember the explanation of the penalties that I didn't know existed. But what those reasons, to me, are reasons to limit it to 2. Because if you limit it to 2, then residents, if they're aware of it, residents will be more willing to complain by 4 or 5 rather than giving them the 4 and waiting for 5 and 6. And you can't, there's no, how do you enforce that they're not selling stuff they're bringing in that is not their personal items? So that's the other reason I have for limiting it to 2.
It's been pretty evident when someone is selling pottery on an ongoing basis versus someone that's selling clothing
right.
and again miscellaneous household
items. Yeah.
So it's been pretty easy to detect that.
Yeah,
and pottery is a good example because then you're getting into the R1 resident area becoming a commercial zone, and that's a danger I see.
Sure. And I don't think the number is as significant as the amount of nuisance that it generates, right? So if this man is selling his pottery every week, whether it's 1 time or 5 times,
right.
It's not what is expected in a residential area. So,
right.
So
we're allowing him to sell whatever he has.
4 times.
4 times.
Right.
And then expecting a neighbor to complain before there's 5.
Yeah. And
where
we also,
I would support 2. And a neighbor complained when there gets to be 3 or 4.
Sure. And we also have the city code compliance officers now that go out looking for that sort of thing. As
yeah.
Well.
Is that actually happening? I assumed that the officer that was hired because we had income from the cannabis area, that he was going to be really busy in the cannabis area. Is that new, he's not new anymore, but that employee, is he having time to go around and inspect buildings and
we have several people involved, if you want to call it, in code compliance. There's someone in the community development department who's full-time code compliance officer. They're looking for, we'll say, private property violations. The police department has a community services technician. They're also out. They're looking at more public right-of-way things,
right.
72-hour parking. Cannabis is almost fully contained by one of our detectives in the police department. So all sorts of facets of code compliance going on in the city. I will just add, because this came up when the council gave us some direction to add this back in. We looked at the surrounding cities, and for what it's worth, this mimics what they do. I will tell you candidly that some are three and some are four. That's pretty much the... I'll say the standard that you will see in surrounding communities here.
Okay.
Any other items?
I was going to go back to the elevator thing. Is there a maximum width and length on that, so that somebody doesn't do one that, you know, you can put a gurney in?
I mean, and again, in a commercial application, that might be true, but yeah. A lot less concerned about it in a large commercial building. I think we would hold it to the, you know,
staff
this
discretion.
Well, I wouldn't call discretion. If you need an elevator for access, how big does that elevator need to be? You know, 6x6? I mean, I can't imagine it. I think anything larger than that would be overkill and probably not meeting the true purpose of this, which is, you know, a resident accent. So,
okay. So we're not calling them PUDs anymore. They're detached multi-unit?
Yeah, just semantics, but I think, you know, you look at the project at 13, on South 13th at Highland, which was called named
Highland Cove.
You know, there's a project. Yeah, technically it's a PUD, but, you know, it was 16 attached and detached units. So I think that's probably more appropriate today to call that a cluster development, and so we're kind of changing the vernacular a little bit.
Yeah, not really saying multifamily anymore, saying multi-unit, like removing the word family.
Correct. That's actually kind of a noticeable change, and some of it also stems from SB 9, because it's, even though it's a what we've traditionally called a single-family residential zone, but here you're allowing attached units as part of SB 9, so we've changed that to... single unit or single dwelling unit, and but I think the two will still live within the code and be interchangeable, but per the definition, it's the same thing. Whatever you want to call it, it has a definition.
So if you split an R1 lot, you can't do ADUs?
Under the SB 9 provision, if you want to split that lot, you cannot put an ADU. You can put a maximum of two units on either one of those lots.
Okay.
But those units could actually be attached.
Okay. So they'd be more affordable by design, probably, than an ADU. So it'd still require parking as opposed to an ADU?
Correct. You were required to have one parking space per unit as part of the SB9.
And... still the one guest per unit or per two units for the...
No guest parking, just one parking space per
okay.
unit.
All right. And, let's see.
Can I...
Go ahead.
You remind me of a question from a resident that... So he has evidently a... house and an ADU, and he wanted to know, and I told him to go to staff, I don't know if he ever did, he wanted to know if he could add another ADU to that, I guess, or another building to that, and then rent them both.
Well, I think we can get into specifics when we have a real
okay.
But I will, just as an example,
what you may see is someone had an existing ADU on their lot. They can now actually subdivide that lot, and there's no longer an ADU. There's an individual residence on each lot, and they could sell that lot.
Conversely,
okay, I got you. That would be my answer. Thank you.
Conversely, you could also be a single family home or unit, construct an ADU that's detached, and then if you're the property owner and you live in one of the units, you can also then convert a portion of the existing home into what's called a junior ADU, and then that deed restricts the property that at least the ADU or the primary residence is deed restricted and the property owner has to live there, but essentially that's three units. Okay. Primary, ADU, junior ADU.
Yeah, okay.
Good to know.
Wow, boy, that gets confusing to me.
Yeah,
I'm sorry to interrupt.
Lots
Go
of
ahead.
Possibilities.
Go ahead, Commissioner. I'm sorry.
I just saw on the definitions the word regress for, I thought what meant maybe it was meant to be recess. Like regress spaces instead of recess. But
yeah, it should be recessed. Oh. There may be some other vocabulary in there that needs to be updated, and we're going to do one more thorough review before this goes to the council to make any clarifications like that. But we would consider those non-substantive. It's just using, I think, a better word that might mean the same thing. But for architectural vernacular, probably one that you use more often, recess.
That's the only reason I noticed it. That's all I had. Thanks.
All right. Commissioners, anything else?
No. And thank you all for listening to my comments and concerns.
Sure. So did I saw some frantic typing over there. Did the staff come up with a better way for us to make a motion for this?
Just to clarify, and we actually, because I did prepare the resolution, I just didn't put it in the packet. So you would be amending your motion to include the adoption or recommendation adoption of this LCP resolution. And again, minor changes to section 4.25 and 8.20 to clarify that those projects need to be consistent with the local coastal program or require a coastal development permit. So you can make a motion and add as amended by staff.
Okay. Then I will make a motion to do we have to do the coastal zone one first?
No, you can do this all in one motion, actually.
Okay. So I move that we adopt a negative declaration and approve the updates to the land use element and development code, including the exceptions stated by staff, and I don't know exactly what we do to the coastal zone. We're getting a permit.
Including the revisions by staff to include the LCP resolution.
Okay,
and
perfect.
The two that you noted. We got it.
Okay, okay. Thank you for that motion. Commissioner Holden, is there a second?
I'll second.
Thank you. I have a motion and a second. Can I get a roll call, please?
Commissioner Holden?
Yes.
Commissioner McLaughlin?
Yes.
Commissioner Rodman?
No.
And Chair Halverson?
Yes. Okay, motion passes. And thank you all for all staff's work and all the consultants' work. That was a big deal.
It is.
So I guess we are down to the commissioners' comments. If we're not out of words yet, do any of the commissioners have any comments they would like to make? We're back here in this nice new shiny rebuilt city council chamber.
Yes,
that's my comment. Anybody else?
Yeah, nice.
I haven't noticed any updates in any of the hotels that are being built, but maybe there are some under that are not recognizable by breaking the ground and doing anything.
All right. Well, I'm sure our update from the director will include that.
I encourage that, yes. That's all I have.
All right. Then I would turn it over to Director Buckingham.
Oh, well, Commissioner Rodman, do you want an update on the hotels?
Yes. Please.
The only update, but it's a significant update, is the
950 El Camino Real, the vacant graded lot there. They're now through their second plan review. So they are getting very close to having a permit that will be ready to issue. And again, they're indicating it will be sometime towards the end of the year, but they are definitely making progress and, again, very close to being able to pull a permit. So, the other projects, again, that there are other things that are going on behind the scenes, but no formal submittals to city staff yet.
Okay. And that reminds me of one other question, if I may. I have noticed that there are a number of vacant lots that an applicant has come to us and gotten the approval to build something, and it appears there's no action, there's no nothing. Eventually they have to come before us and ask for more time, but there is nothing, no enforcement or anything other than that.
Correct. An applicant gets a project approved, they have no obligation to ever move forward with the project.
Yeah.
Most do.
Yeah, you can sell it, they can do whatever they want, and yeah, okay. That's too bad.
Anything else?
I have a question on one of the projects. It was quite a while ago at Sandcastle and Ritchie. I think it's on Sandcastle. There was a home that was putting on a second story or something, and the neighbor was going to spend all their money.
Yeah, so that home was approved. It was never constructed.
Right. I saw it today. And,
yeah. And in an unrelated project, that person has done some landscaping and other improvements, but somebody bought the lot and chose not to develop it. So.
Okay. I was just watching them because it's in my neighborhood.
Yeah, rather unusual, we'll say, but yeah.
Okay.
So all I'll say is it's strange being back in person. We're going to continue this, by the way, and so we will have a few items on your June Planning Commission. So not only do you have to mark your calendars, but you have to drive the 1 or 2 miles to get here as well.
Yes.
So, sorry for the inconvenience.
Bad commute.
And the June date, do you have?
First Tuesday of every month. So June 7th, I believe. Yeah.
Okay.
6 o'clock.
6 p.m.
Very good.
All right. With no other business, I adjourn this meeting at 7:16.